The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
This is from The Hidden Lamp. Stories and Koans from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. Satchajo weeps. When Satchajo, as disciple of Hakuin, was old, she lost her granddaughter, which grieved her very much. An old man from the neighborhood came and admonished her, "Why are you wailing so much? If people hear this, they'll say, the old lady once studied with Hakuin and was enlightened, so now why is she mourning her granddaughter so much? You ought to lighten up a bit." Satchajo glared at her neighbor and scolded him. "You bald-headed fool, what do you know? My tears and weeping are better for my granddaughter than incense, flowers, and lamps." The old man left without a word. Good morning. Thank you. I'm grateful for your being here today to practice together the Dharma, especially those of you who are new. Welcome. So this is an 18th century story with a student of the famous Rinzai master, Hakuin Ngaku. He's known for his irreverence. And his paintings are actually at the Japan Society now, a lot of them, if you want to see his expression in ink. I've loved him. He's kind of a revolutionary in Zen. I don't normally name talks, but so one came to me after having breakfast with the residents, and it's Total Eclipse of the Heart. Total Eclipse of the Heart. So Satchajo was actually a niece and student of Hakuin, who was, his time period was 1685 to 1768. And he's known for that famous koan, "We know the sound of two hands clapping. What's the sound of one hand clapping? Show me, don't tell me." And the student has to show. So that was his koan. I've seen it on tea bags now. It's really funny. I was like, wow, on the tag, "What's the sound of one hand clapping?" Amazing to plant that in us. So in one story about Satchajo, it will give us a good sense of her character. Her father was upset that she wasn't finding a suitor, that she wasn't getting married, didn't have a husband, and he asked her to pray to Kanan Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And so she did this day and night and day and night during all of her activities, and before long she experienced an awakening. And one day her father peeked in her room and saw her sitting on a copy of the Lotus Sutra, which is one of the texts of the Mahayana school. It's an important text, and she's sitting on it, right? Like, how irreverent. And her father yells, "What are you doing sitting on that precious scripture?" he shouted, and she responded, "How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass?" Don't you love her? I just fell in love. She comes forth with such a tender question, really. How is this sutra different from my ass? It's really bringing up this, what's profane and what's sacred, right? And she's really being intimate with the great matter. She's giving us an in to this great matter of life and death. What's sacred? What's profane? Where do we live? Where do we divide? My kind of girl. Anyway, it's such a comfort to meet her in this story, how she's being so completely human, not hiding her grief, weeping and wailing over the death of her granddaughter. A great awakened adept crying, weeping. Is that Zen? Having just lost my Dharma brother, Yukon, many of us, this koan helps me speak to the grieving process. And it's not like you may not have known him, but you know this yourself. We have all had loss in our life. And I have this one chance to grieve his death. This one chance to grieve his death. And I accept impermanence, not as a fact, for real. But once again, I'm finding it crucial to scour my heart with sorrow, with the sorrow that's been presented. I have chosen this. And I call it good grief. Good grief. Because it makes things open up. Heartbreak makes the heart open further and further if we can bear it. We all have cried from loss. Some of us more than others. One of our dear friends at the funeral told me, dear friend at UConn, knew him before I did, said she hasn't cried a tear. And I said, that's okay. That's okay. You know, we're not on any schedule or we don't have to be a certain way in this. That's your path. And there's no way I would ever attempt to divide us by liters of tears we have shed. Rather to see how this unites us, how our grief unites us. Because we all have grieving. We all have seasons of feeling sadnesses, stresses, overwhelmedness, fearfulness, frustratedness. This is the weather report. What is grief? And can we respect it and not fear it? Can we share it? Are we sharing it? Can we let it work in and through our body, this incredible raw ingredients that form it, and to bring us to this life of gratitude in the process, to bring us closer to express our gratitude for the impermanence and why we care for things, why we don't get nihilistic, why we can feel, how we can get closer to the most important thing for us. What is that for you? Over time and in entering the experience, I can say what grief is not. It's not a thing. Grief is not a thing or even a feeling. It's a process, a continuum of emotions that unfolds at its own pace. We don't get to know in advance how much time it will take and when it will appear. It's been so odd sometimes, not just for Yukon, but just grief in general, like when it appears, you know, just. And no one can tell us how much time it's going to take. And I guess it was about 10 years ago in earnest, I began looking at teachings on grief, having been filled with so much of it from something that happened in my own life, a partner I left deeply, departed, not in a physical death, but it was really the beginning of my own great death to enter that experience fully, which I chose to do. And I was practicing to let the house fall down. As Buddha said, don't build this house back up again. And I was, since I was in practice, I had guidance and enough training where I, when it happened, I said, oh, this is why I've been sitting on a cushion for 26 years. For this. The ability or the reality of hearing that statement, we can bring everything to the path of awakening. I wanted to find out if that was true. Like, everything, but not this. No, this is going to take, this is a takedown. No, no, everything we experienced can be brought to the path of awakening. It's really true. And I wanted to know, is everything really workable that we encounter in our life? Is it workable? Is everything, as teachers have taught, enlightened energy? That every thought is an enlightened thought. Every emotion is an enlightened emotion if we practice it. I wanted to know. And so there was this constant dropping in and out of this an endlessly entangled web of wanting to know why. Such a hard, endless question. Why? Why? Why do I have to suffer? Why did this happen to me? Why can't I get over it? Why did this person have to? Why? Endless. I was like, that isn't a good one. Why was not a good question. It took a while, but that wasn't the question. Wasn't the right one. Most often, we can't even find the reasons or words to make sense of sadness, what's called, or to recognize the weather of a season. We can't even find the words to speak about grief or feeling or an emotion. We pick some. We've got about five that we use all the time. I'm feeling grief, anger, you know, it's just like five of them. But Buddha said there's 80,000 emotions. Whoa. So I wondered what Buddha taught about grief and grieving. It seemed like when he was dying, he told the monastics, don't grieve for me. Right? Ananda, his faithful attendant, was weeping his eyes out to see the Buddha so ill. And then the Blessed One said to the monks, where is Ananda? And one of them said, Lord, Venerable Ananda, having gone into that building, stands leaning against the door jamb, weeping. Here I am, still in training, this is Ananda speaking, with work left to do, and the total unbinding of my teacher is about to occur. The teacher has had such sympathy for me. Buddha said, ask him to come over. So the monastic went over and said, teacher wants you. Down to the principal's office. Get on the bench. And the teacher, he says, the teacher calls you my friend. As you say, my friend, Venerable Nanda replied. And then he went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. And as he was sitting there, the Blessed One said to him, enough, Ananda. Don't grieve. Don't lament. Haven't I already taught you the state of growing different with regard to all things dear and appealing? The state of becoming separate? The state of becoming otherwise? What else is there to expect? It's impossible that one could forbid anything born, existent, fabricated, and subject to disintegration from disintegrating. The Buddha comforted him, saying, "Do not grieve, Ananda. I am old and feeble and cannot live forever. It is natural for everything born to die." For a long time, Ananda, you have waited on the Tathagata with physical acts of goodwill, helpful, happy, wholehearted, without limit, with verbal acts of goodwill, with mental acts of goodwill, helpful, happy, without limit. You are the one who has made merit. Commit yourself to exertion, and soon you will be without mental fermentations. Buddha taught that grief is one form of dukkha, of suffering, which often arises due to our attachment to impermanent pleasures. Just like everything else in our practice, we have a choice to be present with what is in each moment. And in the so many stories and poems of the women, there are stories about and lines about how they work with their grief. Yubiri lost her daughter. Patakara lost her husband, then two children, then her entire family in a house fire, like within a week. Childbirth. Kisugatami carrying her dead child, going around, and finally meets the Buddha and says, "Go to a house and bring me a mustard seed. Talk to people. Bring me a mustard seed from anyone that has not lost someone. Bring me that mustard seed." Kisugatami went and came back. "I can't find a mustard seed anywhere." So sometimes we could feel so alone in grief and loss. We are not alone. I know that many of us, as I did, sometimes try and move quickly to try and transcend grief by reaching for intellect with phrases. "Ah, that's the truth of impermanence." Then there's our super ego voice, "Just let go." And actually, there's no letting go till we let in and through. You may have some other good ones. I remember working with a Tibetan teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, and he was saying how Americans in practice like to dump sutras on top of things they're feeling, thinking that the sutra is going to sort of like take it away, and they don't want to go through the embodiment of the experience. He said, "It doesn't work. You can't like, yes, the liturgy is so helpful and can open channels, but you can't dump it on top, right? You can't just like Avalokita on top of something like." I hope it does that. When things go awry here, Yuna and I have a joke now. We blame it on Mercury is in retrograde. So eventually I settle on, this is just so. It is just so. Not why, it is just so. There are causes and conditions too numerous to find, keep track of, point to. We are movement. Everything is in motion. It seems fixed and solid, but it's not. I asked my teacher once, because I was grieving so much, I said, "Is grieving self-centered? Is grieving self-centered?" He said, "It could be. And there are times it is not. that to enter the process and to release the pain and suffering accumulated from who knows how long and what we're an amalgam of, I don't know, that it brings new life into this gigantic body and into everything and everyone just by our own being with it. And that is not self-centered. But it could easily, as I noticed, when I was deep in it, it would also pick up on every suffering I've had, like the kitchen sink, we say. So there was just the grief, and then I was sort of like shooting the next arrow and bringing in like everything else that troubled me. That was more a self coming in, I recognized. You see the difference there? So it's subtle, but it feels different. It feels different because one, you actually feel purified, like when you're just grieving and there's nothing else underneath than when there's something else is being pulled in. You could feel that. So who doesn't feel grief? I mean, really, we're on a seriously warming planet. I don't have to name everything. We've come out of a pandemic, but within that, the feelings that came in that time of being alone, isolated, there's still grief happening. Things we saw and experienced, that's still working its way through. We may find that at times appearing. Wars with weapons of mass destructions where we can just obliterate ourselves. The grief of that possibility. So we have this kind of silent ceremony of letting this in together. It's a ceremony that we're all in right now, holding it with each other, letting it in here together. We already know what's in front of us, but at the same time, what is occurring in the world is unknown. We don't know. We actually don't know where it's going or what is happening ever. What is being asked of us? What are we up against that is being asked to be discovered, recognized, realized? When grief shatters all that we have known and hold dear, if we can let that shattering happen, a great expansion comes. A great, great expansion comes. And nature does it naturally. You know, sometimes volcanoes have to explode and earthquakes have to happen. Things shatter to make room for the new. It's said that when Buddha spoke in the Lotus Sutra, there were earthquakes, tsunamis even. That's how loud that roar was and shaking the consciousness that was forming, that was opening, that was expanding. And so when I looked at Buddha's teachings on grief and how to deal with and perhaps heal the wounds of grief, it was a laying out of many steps, as Buddha does, lots of steps and lists, lots of mental training that leads to the acceptance of loss, all the way to the total eclipse, the total release from grief and the pains along with it. And at first I was a little put off by the steps, but I saw that it wasn't ignoring, it wasn't intellectual. It was actually a process that wasn't steps, but it was when you enter it, you were in a process which churned up everything and also, and actually had you see, gave you a path, a view that said, yes, you're going to see this. Yes, this will happen. It was comforting. It was comforting. And the message that came through is that a good percent of our being with our grief grows out of welcoming it, experiencing it, being mindful, awareness of the flow, to not freeze in it, to see ourselves freeze and unfreeze and freeze and unfreeze, the stream enterer, keep entering the stream, right? We're in flow, keep entering the stream. And that's where liturgy really can help, to just help me. May I enter the stream. May I enter the flow. Not knowing what that's going to look like. Not knowing outcomes. When we are letting in, acknowledging, and keeping bittersweet company with it, of it, we can see the root. And if we practice grief in accord with its nature, it can be liberated. It can be liberated. We are truly liberated. And everything is just as it was. When Satyajo was old, she lost her granddaughter, which grieved her very much. And the old man from the neighborhood came and admonished her, "Why are you wailing so much? If people hear this, they'll say, the old lady once studied with Hakuin and was enlightened, so now why is she mourning her granddaughter so much? You ought to lighten up a bit." And she glared at him and scolded him. "You bald-headed fool, what do you know? My tears and weeping are better for my grandmother than incense, flowers, and lamps." And he left without a word. I imagine, like when you yell at a dog and their tail goes under, that's why I see him walking away. Is there a difference between Satyajo's grief and the grief that troubles us so much? The grief we want to deny or get over as soon as possible? The grief that knots and twists us up inside? Yes and no. How do we not cover grief up in ceremony and celebrate it and embrace it? She's being so completely human, weeping and wailing over the death of her granddaughter. What an appropriate response. Maybe what we not, may not expect in a Dharma story and of our ideas of how to let go of attachment. I see her openly weeping, throwing herself down, perhaps crying at the jar of ashes in front of her at the funeral. I see people coming to visit her and her not ready to interact with people, not ready for their visits. She's too sad to interact, honoring that. I had moments of feeling this, for sure. I'm not ready to give a talk. I'm not ready to interact, and I'm listening and moving in ways I trust and can enter the stream. The old man, "Why are you wailing so much?" If people hear this, they'll say, "The old lady that studied with Hakuin was enlightened. Why is she mourning her granddaughter so much? You ought to lighten up." When is it ever our place to tell someone who's suffering to lighten up? When? I've done that. Not in those words, but with that in me. Get over it. I've bought it myself. Don't worry, this will pass. Don't tell me that right now. That's not it. It's not it. We need to be this old man. We are him, right? Was he trying to alleviate Satyajo's suffering? Was he? Was he trying to help her? But he seems more worried about his reputation. Perhaps he's worried about himself, the own blemish of his image. Freaking out because she's rearranging his projection of a Zen person. I'm not supposed to do this. We're supposed to be okay. It's an impermanence. Is this an expression of his discomfort, of being with his own vulnerability? Is he maintaining a system of oppression? The message, you're not supposed to be grieving. It's done. It's past. Placing his own unrecognized grief on another's body. Is this an act of hatred on display? I don't know. I don't know for sure. These are just questions I had as I was feeling into the interaction that was happening, like without knowing, but we don't know. We don't know for sure. And that happens with each of us. We don't know for sure. And we might be putting stuff on people when we don't know this person's experience. She snaps out of her wailing, showing her wakefulness. Cuts right through. You bald-headed fool. Can you see her? She's just like weeping, gets this comment. What? She's awake. She goes right to it, right? What do you know? What do you know? My tears of weeping are better for my granddaughter than incense, flowers, and lamps. Complete presence of mind, cutting him to shreds with her clarity. She breaks it all up, and she understands her anger. She understands the wisdom of anger and the wisdom of rage. I feel that. I feel her rage. I feel her anger, and she uses it skillfully because it's just an energy. We get all bummed. Anger gets such a bad rap. I'm angry. Well, use it well. Like, don't let it, like, what do you want it to aim it at? Like, don't make it, like, bad, but make it helpful. That's practice. She does it. Grieving should not be rushed. It cannot be. So please don't let anyone ever tell you that. There are We grieve because we want to get back to our heart. And that doesn't have a language. That doesn't have a language. We can't talk our way through back to our heart. It doesn't have a language. We do not disappear, nor do we drown, neither do we cry forever. But if from time to time these tears are called from us, to trust, to let be, then they're no longer frightening. They're a small ceremony, keeping us close to the world, keeping us close to our heart, to our own being, to make us less brittle, more resilient. You feel that afterwards. That's that cleansing, because then you know that in yourself, and you can meet it in others. You can meet that grief in others. That's compassion. We weep because something is pouring in and we're overflowing, because it's impossible to say anything in some moments, and it's equally impossible not to offer something back. Right? So what can we offer back? We were talking about gratitude. Presence, yeah. Presence. Like, how many people helped me just looking at me? How we helped each other just in our presence. The whole funeral was presence, presence, presence. In one of D.T. Suzuki's early books, there's a story about someone who meets him and asks, "After you've been enlightened, do you suffer anymore?" people ask this kind of question. Maybe you've had it. If you're enlightened, if I get enlightened, will I suffer anymore? D.T. Suzuki said, oh, yes, you do. Does that strike your Zen box? And the person said, well, have you suffered? And D.T. Suzuki said, yes, when my wife died, I cried bitter tears. And the person said, well, then what's the point of practice? And he said, oh, my tears had no roots. My tears had no roots. I was really struck by that when I read it a while ago in this research. Daito Roshi wrote, we need to understand rootlessness itself. Rootless means the roots are gone. They're either cut off or undeveloped. When used in terms of people, rootless means that they've no close ties, no connections. Well, what kind of thing has no connections to anything? Is that what the Dharma is about? This is Daito Roshi, you can hear him. All dharmas are nothing but rootless, he says. They're not connected to anything, but contain everything. Do you understand? Do you understand? They contain everything, not in your head, because it's easy enough to understand intellectually, but do you understand in your body? He says, that being the case, where do all these boundaries come from? Where do I end and you begin? What creates these edges? It's got to do with our mind and how we use it, how you see yourself and how you see the universe. I cry a lot. Didn't always. Well, maybe that's not true. Maybe I've been a crier. Some of us are. Some of us, maybe you can't even remember the last time. That's okay. But they have so many flavors, right? Tears of gratitude, tears of absurdity, tears of adorableness. Oh my God, I was in this Zenkai, and there's a server carrying a pitcher so beautifully. It just made me cry. It was just the loving holding it up and delivering it. It was just, I didn't expect it. I just started weeping. It was so beautiful. Ridiculousness makes us cry. Homelessness. Tenderness, all kinds of nesses that we are, bring all kinds of flavors of tears, maybe more than Ben and Jerry's made of ice cream. Are there roots in my tears? Sometimes. I see where I turn to ice and freeze, but I'm aware, I have awareness. And so I can work with that. We can work with the freeze, the defrost. Sometimes, and through practice, like Satchido, I can just cry. I can just cry and honor every salty, watery drop from my oceanic beginnings as my pleasure to release to what is. And you? Your tears? Do we cling to some root, some source, some truth about our tears? Or are they just tears? Can they just be tears? Can they be that free to pour out? My tears has no roots. Grief has no roots. No stories. No blame. They're just your tears. Just grief. That's complete freedom. That's a total eclipse of the heart. releasing Yukon. This river of sadness becomes the river that pulses deep inside all of us, hidden from view, but informing our lives at every turn. So can we let it be so free? Can we have this ceremony, be in ceremony, know we are in ceremony together, always? And Zazen is where we can quiet and enter our innermost chamber, be present with our breath, sit in awareness. Grief can include our joy, our anger, our depression, our tears, our loneliness. We sit in this chamber for a while, and it's called a path. Just sitting and observing without judging is a powerful way to care for ourselves, is a powerful way to care for each other. We sit in a place of acceptance, even before we're ready to accept our loss. We just sit in a mountain of acceptance. So I think I'll end there. Had some poems. There's such good poems. You want to hear one? Time for one? Well, I've actually four. Okay. This one I like, called The Thing Is. It just gives us a something we can't touch. Poets sometimes keep us in that mystery, right? If you're a poet, we can stay in the mystery of who we are. The Thing Is, this is by Ellen Bass. To love life, to love it even when you have no stomach for it and everything you've held dear crumbles like burnt paper in your hands, your throat filled with the silt of it. When grief sits with you, it's tropical heat, thickening the air, heavy as water, more fit for gills than lungs. When grief weights you like your own flesh, only more of it, an obesity of grief, you think, how can a body withstand this? Then you hold life like a face between your palms, a plain face. No charming smile, no violet eyes. And you say, yes, I will take you. I will love you again. Just that one.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.